Adenum introduces zero-touch routers for multiple dwelling units. Mail Protector secures outside funding for rapid growth. Epson's got some new A3 inkjet MFPs and more. It's all coming up. Channel Pro Weekly, episode 37, Testosterone Gone Wild. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Channel Pro Weekly, episode 37. I am your host with the most, technology editor and online guy. Matt Whitlock is my name. Joining me this week is senior news editor and fellow bro to kick off this man show. We'll get to that in a second. Mr. Rich Freeman.
Hey there.
So notably absent this week is our executive editor and person who keeps this show not only multi-gender, but generally on track and of high quality. So this is going to be Channel Pro Weekly Man Show Edition. Rich, should we do a lot of burping and scratching during this episode? Or should we try to keep it as normal as possible?
But, well, I mean, if it's going to be the Man Show Edition, let's just go all the way there. Yeah, you know, belching and scratching and talking about sports.
Not too goats, early, though, right?
Yeah, no.
That would be the farming edition.
Yeah.
So, as I say, I went back and I listened to the last episode, and I have to admit, when we got to the part they were talking about goats, I swear, I actually, like, busted out laughing. It was hilarious. totally insane. So, we should bust out the beers for this one.
Yeah.
Although I'm not actually having beer. It's 9:30 in the morning on a Thursday. I'm having coffee.
Me too.
Yeah. What kind of coffee are you having?
Whatever they're serving here in the hotel room I'm in right now. I didn't check the brand.
Ah. Yeah. I'm having what would normally be like normal coffee, although now all coffee that we make that comes from our bean grinder, all now has a hint of cinnamon. So my wife makes these homemade apple chips in the dehydrator, and they're really, really good. And when she started making them, we only had one grinder, which is this Burmill kind of coffee grinder. So she would grind fresh cinnamon in there. Well, little did we probably realize at the time is that now every coffee that comes through there now has cinnamon with it. So every coffee we now drink is basically cinnamon coffee.
Which is a good thing, an okay thing.
I like cinnamon, but I guess sometimes I do want just a normal cup of coffee without the cinnamon. So hopefully in 10 or 15 years, we'll get all of the cinnamon ground out of the coffee maker and we can enjoy regular coffee again.
Yeah. Hang in there.
Yeah, but until then, it's cinnamon coffee for me. All right, so you're out on the road this week, right?
I am.
So tell us where you're at and what you're doing.
Well, interestingly enough, I am just up the road from you a little ways. I am in Chicago right now. Looking over Memorial Park, as a matter of fact. Beautiful view here from the Swiss Hotel. I have been attending the CompTIA annual member meeting this week.
Oh, I didn't know you were in the neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have come over.
I know. I should have.
You could have met the goats.
Yeah. I could have taken some pictures, put them online. Yeah. Jeez.
So when do you fly out?
In just a few hours.
Oh, okay. So you're getting ready to pack up and head to O'Hare?
Yeah.
All right, well, next time you're in the area, you got to let me know. We'll plan on an extra day. So that'll be fun. I've had another week, so I will say this now just to kind of cover my bases and to help law enforcement possibly someday. So if I am ever found murdered in my kitchen... Cecilia did it.
Yes. Yeah, that in fact, when the detectives knock on my door, yeah, that's where I'm going to send them first.
Prime suspect, Miss Cecilia. In fact, maybe that's why she's not on this podcast, is because she's secretly traveling here right now with machete in hand.
Either that or she's in a straitjacket, basically.
Yeah, so you never have to worry about looking bad, Rich. So this week, one of my prime focuses, amongst some other distractions, was getting my next article written for the next issue, which was supposed to ship, I think, probably like last week. But it was a tough piece to write. But it was a good one. So the switch is on talking about differences between managed switches and smart switches. There seems to be a lot of confusion there, and so I got our friends from Linksys on the phone with some of their product engineers, and we talked about smart switches, managed switches, and kind of what resellers need to know and who they're for and what the big differences are. So I think it was a good piece, but late as always. So death is on its way to me, courtesy our executive editor. So that was my week, but we have some stories for this week to cover, and I apologize to all if I sound a little congested, because I'm coming down with a cold. So the kids have struck again, our little disease carriers. But I'll do my best to make it through here and not blow my nose right into the microphone. So, Rich, Aditum is in the news. What do we got from them?
So they announced a new sort of optional feature for their service this week, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, and part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this is just because Aditum is one of those interesting companies out there that probably doesn't get talked about maybe as much as it should, or at least they deal in a corner of the industry maybe that doesn't get talked about as much as it should. So. Aditum, A-D-I-T-U-M, they're a company that basically provides internet service to apartment buildings and office buildings, multi-unit structures, basically. And they do it in a very MSP-friendly kind of way, so that you as the MSP can come to the owner or manager of a building and say, hey, I'm going to help you provide high-speed wireless networking access to all the units in your building here, and it's going to be a great amenity for the building, and you're going to be able to keep everything, you know, all your units occupied, and maybe even raise your rent, etc. And I'm also going to share some of the revenue from that connection with you, so you'll make a little money off of that, and I obviously, as the MSP, I'm going to be making some money too. So in terms of the announcement this week, in the past, when an MSP signed up a new account, they would go off somewhere. Quite often they would go off to Best Buy, but sometimes they would go to their favorite distributor and they would acquire routers. And then as units in this building signed up for the service, they would connect and program the routers, basically, and get everything hooked up. And it was not exactly a complicated process, but it was something that they had to do. Starting this week, Aditum now has this zero-touch router service that you can use. And essentially, you're buying the router from Aditum at a perfectly reasonable price, by the way, and it arrives pre-configured, essentially. So you scan a barcode on the box, and the one thing you have to do basically is associate a given router with a given account so that the system on the back end knows which account that router is going to be supporting. But from that point on, it's literally just a matter of plugging it in, and everything else that needs to happen happens automatically on the back end. And the whole thing is so easy that an MSP doesn't even really need to be involved. You know, the building manager can do it because there's nothing really technical about it. And so it just makes the service a lot easier to deliver and therefore a lot more profitable. There's less overhead involved in terms of driving out to buildings and doing all this sort of manual administration. So that in and of itself I thought was, you know, interesting and worth mentioning, but I also just wanted to bring it up because it feels like there's this kind of cool business opportunity here that, like I said, just doesn't get discussed all that often. If you're an MSP, you're looking for a new line of business, a new revenue source, this is something to think about that. You know, depending on where you're located, there are probably lots of multi-unit buildings in your region, in your area. You know, many of which, most of which, don't have high-speed bandwidth. Here is an entirely new service that you can provide, which is relatively easy to deliver and, you know, provides monthly recurring revenue, basically. So just kind of a cool business opportunity, I think, to keep in mind.
So who's the ISP behind this?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you're essentially connected to Adidem and their management infrastructure. I don't know who they are partnering with beyond that.
Probably like whoever's like in the area. So if Xfinity owns the wires, you're probably riding them, I would assume, as a partner.
I mean, that would make sense. Yeah, I don't know.
Or something like that, you know, fiber or, I guess, but the building's got to get high speed connectivity and be wired for this, because each person gets this little router, so it's not all. I'm just trying to figure out how this works. All I know is that there are three middlemen in this model here to get service to a customer. That's a lot of middlemen, don't you think?
And therefore, what the price, you know, the customer winds up paying more than they would otherwise? Or is it just you're thinking complicated?
No, I'm just thinking that's a pretty complicated model, just to distribute all the service revenues, and just that's a lot of middlemen, you know?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Adidem tries to arrange the whole thing in a way so that that complexity is their problem, basically. So, you know, the MSP and the building owner and so on, they're not dealing with all these different people. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Adidem itself has a lot of people to deal with.
Yeah. So you don't have to use their hardware. You can still continue to bring your own hardware, it seems. And that doesn't change any of the pricing or anything. But I mean, who wouldn't want just a simple deployment method? Like this, if you're the building owner and you're farming this stuff out, I mean, this seems like a no-brainer to not have to program routers for your tenants. So very cool. Very interesting model. I'd be very curious to learn more about this and how it all comes together. Because it just seems like there's so many components and pieces and people involved that it just doesn't seem like it would be easy, but maybe it is.
The founder and CEO of the company is a guy named Brian Higgins, who you've probably met because he has been at some of our live events, and I don't know if he's going to be at additional ones in the future, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. And yeah, by all means, chat him up about this. He would be more than happy, I'm sure, to kind of lay out how it all fits together.
Yeah, that'd be neat. I'm going to make a note to do that. So, but when we're not talking about putting routers in multiple dwelling units, we're talking about getting funding. Totally related topics, right?
Yeah.
So Mail Protector's on the rise now. What's going on with them?
Well, long-time regular listeners to this podcast will remember that we discussed on this show once upon a time the email encryption solution that Mail Protector introduced around about August, if I'm remembering right, which had a very interesting model in terms of how they separated the data from the encryption keys and so on, and it sort of made the service lightweight in terms of the data storage requirements and more secure because you don't have the keys and the data in the same place. So the solution is called Force Encrypt, one word, F-O-R-C-E, and then, you know, encrypt from the E forward. So you can get more details about how that works on the Mail Protector site. Mail Protector had some news this week. They have accepted or acquired their first outside funding. It's all been self-funded, the business, since its founding. They have a what's called a mezzanine debt deal with an outside provider now. They Mail Protector would not specify exactly how much money is involved. It's not an enormous sum because the company they're working with, which is called Lighter Capital, specializes in investing between $50,000 and $2 million in up-and-coming technology companies, typically startups. And so this is not, you know, they are not acquiring equity in the business. They are going to have no management role or even really advisory role that I'm aware of. They are just, making a debt investment, essentially, in this business. And the timing, I mean, the reason that Mail Protector is doing this, given that they've never done it before, is just that that encryption solution, among other systems that Mail Protector makes, is really kind of taking off, apparently. They really made a push in 2016 to get serious about the channel and making their partner program a little more channel-friendly, making it easier to do business with Mail Protector. And based on what they told me this week, I met with them actually face-to-face here at the CompTIA meeting. Once they did that, once they sort of cleaned up the partner program and the business processes and made dealing with the company simpler, et cetera, it was, as one of the leaders of the company described it to me, it was like flipping on a light switch just in terms of how quickly the business has been growing. And so now they feel like they have this opportunity to grow the business even faster and beyond what they were thinking before if they can bring some money in from outside. So however much money this involves, they're going to spend a bunch of it on people. Doubling headcount is their goal for the relatively near future here. And they're going to be developing new products. They wouldn't talk to me specifically about what kind of products, etc., but there are new products from Mail Protector coming and enhanced editions of existing ones as well, and all that work will be at least partially underwritten by this new funding too.
Yeah, very cool. I've noticed their name in the news quite a bit, and with resellers that I've talked to who are looking for these solutions, their name is popping up quite a bit amongst the people too. So I'm willing to believe that they're growing at a pretty good clip. I have a much more important question, though.
Uh-huh.
So let's say you secure several million dollars in funding, right? Somewhere in the range of zero to probably $10 million is where I'm going to guess this is going to fall. So where's the first place you go to lunch?
I could go in several directions there, but instinct tells me someplace where they're going to serve me a steak an inch thick.
For lunch? You need a steak an inch thick for lunch?
It's a cause for celebration, isn't it?
I suppose so. I was thinking like Indian buffet or even Golden Corral or Pizza Ranch, something with a buffet.
And why is that?
Just because you get to eat a lot of food. Why else would you go to a buffet?
Because endless breadsticks or whatever it is.
That's right. You may not get your 1-inch thick steak, but you can have 17,000 subpar steaks that are overcooked.
Have you? Here's a totally apropos of nothing question that will be fascinating to listeners. Have you ever been to that Indian buffet place near Channel Pro headquarters? Have they ever taken you there?
No. The last time I was out there, we did go to like this really cool kind of deli, and we're gonna go to the Indian buffet place the next time I came, but I've never actually been back. So
okay, well that's something to look forward to.
There's an okay place here in Rockford that I can go. It's kind of small. If I go down to Schaumburg, so kind of by O'Hare where you're at, there's a lot of really great Indian places for Indian buffet. So it's around. It's around, and it's good. Do you like Indian buffet?
I do.
Yeah, it's tasty. Restaurant picks, Indian buffet. Next week on Restaurant Weekly, we will be discussing not Indian buffet, but Greek salad bars.
Mm-hmm.
Where to get the best Greek salad. All right. I think we should take a break. We're gonna have a little bit shorter show than normal, but we'll see if we can, talk and make it run way longer than it needs to by being goofy. But we're gonna take a break. When we come back, we're gonna talk a quick news story on Epson printers. A little interesting story there. We're gonna have an interview with David Walter of MSP SEO Factory. And we got that and a whole bunch more, so stick around, we'll be right back. All right, and we are back with segment two, and we got one more quick news story. So Rich, Epson, they unveiled some new high-speed A3 color inkjet multifunction printers for, like, SMB and departmental kind of use. But what's interesting about these, other than the fact that it's ink, because, like, normally what kind of print technology do you think of for, like, SMB and departmental?
Well, everybody thinks laser first, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, laser would be the go-to technology. And not normally ink, other than maybe, like the Xerox, Phaser, dry ink stuff. But there's... when you think typical inkjet, normally you think, high printing costs and, slow speeds and that kind of stuff, which is, fine for, consumer use and, maybe small office use. But or if you're specifically doing lots of color, with photographs or whatnot. But ink is kind of coming back in a big way, especially, and HP kind of pioneered this about 2 years ago. They started coming out with these inkjet printers that use a full-size printhead, a full-page printhead. So normally when you think inkjet, you think the little cartridges, sliding back and forth the page. Well, these are like, this printhead is stationary, so it kind of almost acts like a laser printer when you print. So you get much higher speeds, and supposedly the consumable cost is better here as well. So it's kind of interesting to see, like, this resurgence of ink products back into the A3 market, and for departmental types of uses. So I just thought that was kind of an interesting one. The new Epson one that they're showing off, it does about 100 one-sided pages per minute, as many 80 duplex pages per minute. It can plug into a standard 110 volt outlet, so like the energy efficiency here is significantly better than comparable laser products. It's priced as you would expect an A3 MFP to be. It's tens of thousands of dollars, but you can get up to about 5,500 sheet page capacity. You do about 100,000 black ISO pages, 50,000 color ones, and the color is obviously going to be very good because it is ink. So this is a pretty cool new kind of resurgence in this category, and I think it's going to keep laser on its toes and. Competition is good. It drives better products and better prices. So,
yeah, it was interesting when I was talking with them about this, interviewing them before this launch was officially announced. They spent quite a bit of time during that conversation talking about ink and ink getting into the office space. They are quite bullish, basically, on office inkjet printers, and I think they view this. Particular product launch. This, I believe, is their first color inkjet with that stationary margin-to-margin printhead you were talking about. But they really view this as a big growing market. And in fact, I'm looking at the article now. They quoted me some data from IDC. Inkjet models already account for 48%. Of office printer shipments today. So, actually there's more office inkjet going on right now than you might suspect. But IDC projects that number is going to go from 48% to 60% by 2020. So that, I mean, it is a growing market. It's not just Epson believing there's opportunity there. Office inkjet printers are definitely on the rise.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, if you look at most SMBs, you know, when you're looking at the small, that's where you're getting a huge shipment of inkjet printers, right? But in the, once you get to the A3 category, though, I mean, the options for ink go way down. So this is there's a lot of growth, I think, into this space that's been dominated by laser and other toner based systems as we go forward. So pretty cool stuff. I thought that was kind of interesting. Also interesting is Gaming Google, and there's no one better at that than the guys at MSP SEO Factory. Is that right, Rich?
Yep, especially if you are an MSP.
That's right. So you get a chance to sit down and talk with David Walter and Johannes?
Johan Beekman. I believe it's pronounced Johan. I hope it is.
Johan, particular interview.
So we're going to listen to an excerpt from an interview I recorded at our SMB Forum event in Atlanta a few weeks back. We were seated at a kind of squeaky table, as you will hear when you're listening to this. Sorry about that, but it shouldn't be too distracting. I was speaking with David Walter and Johan Beekman, who are the two head guys at MSP SEO Factory. And as the name sort of implies, they are a marketing vendor. They specialize in helping MSPs generate leads through search engine optimization. Their technique, as you'll here, relies heavily on original thought leadership content. They develop content for you, they put it out online, and then make sure that people looking for or searching on related topics see your links and thought leadership content first, and then think about contacting you for IT assistance. So you're going to hear two voices in addition to my own. Johan is the gentleman with an accent, just so you know who is who. And the interview began actually with David speaking about why search engine marketing works and works about as well as everybody's favorite marketing tool, which is referrals.
MSPs don't have a challenge converting a referral to a sale because the referral is someone that has need and pain. Those are very easy to close. You could say that's a gimme sell, almost. That's why they like them so much. And so an internet lead, right? So we focus on generating leads. And the reason I feel comfortable in this business is because the leads that are generated, by and large, are people that have need and pain. In other words, they're searching for a solution on the web, and they find the company. And so what the conversion that we're involved in is the thought leadership content that they start reading. They find them because they're top ranked. They find them, and then they read the content. And so by writing these type of articles, people begin to read them. That's what thought leadership is about. They follow the IT company, then they call them. And what we found recently is one of our companies in Dallas told us that when people find them on the internet and they go out to meet them, people ask them about the articles they've read. Tell me more about this article. Tell me more about that article. So the articles are, A, getting them leads. They're helping convert those into prospects. But they're people that have need and pain, and so it's not a challenge for MSPs to close them.
So the service you provide, part of it is you are developing this content that your clients can distribute to their customers or prospects, basically. Now, is there more that you're doing on top of that to kind of make sure that content gets discovered, et cetera?
Oh, no. We write it on their website. We post it. It's a done-for-you service. We provide content, and we post it on their website as a blog. The whole service that we have is about getting them top-ranked on Google. So when a prospect types in IT Support Atlanta, our client MIS solution comes up on page one. That's how they're discovered. Once they click on it and they go to the site, now we feature their content. We change their website so it features the content that we're writing on the homepage. Many sections of different articles we've written, so they go there and they start reading the articles. That's when they reach out to the company and say, you know what, I like your articles. I like the way you're thinking about these topics. I think you're the authority. And then they reach out to the company. That's when the lead's created.
But and you're doing some work basically to make sure that your customers are sorting high on those Google searches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's writing the articles on their site. It's guest blogging. It's changing and optimizing the keywords on their homepage. It's writing Google reviews.
How, very roughly speaking, does the pricing work?
Right now we have basic package, and with that package we've shown that we can get any company for whatever keyword on page one of Google. If they want more, if they want, let's say, more, then yeah, it's we customize it. But that's how we work.
Okay. And so in terms of the volume of original content that you're developing for them, it's whatever it takes basically to get them to a rank?
Whatever it takes, but what we've learned is that we typically write 8 blogs a month. And for some companies, they say it's a lot. We know from experience that that's what you need.
Well, it's 8 blogs a month, but what we found, it was interesting, we had one company that contracted us to write more, almost triple the amount of articles. And they abandoned lots of other services that we had, like social media, Google reviews, and LinkedIn, and they abandoned all that stuff. And another company stuck with our basic plan, which is diverse, which includes guest blogging, social media, articles. It has a whole band of services, multi-channel. And he was able to get top ranked on the first page. And the other company that had more articles never made it. So that really proved to us that it has got to be a diverse. The algorithm reflects a diverse. You can't check one box only and get top ranked.
And so you're covering the social media waterfront, basically Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, et cetera.
Yep.
The two big models for search engine marketing are SEO and pay-per-click. I mean, what are the pros and cons, the differences? What's your take on pay-per-click as a...
Well, pay-per-click works, but two different models, but two different customer groups. So to put it black and white, so pay-per-click works, you switch it on, you immediately get leads, but they are typically cold. People just searching and wanting, looking for information. So those are, takes a long time to convert these. So you need to have a process to take them in and to triage them, to work on the ones that really are worthwhile working on. Then you have the SEM. SEM is really tapping into Google search, meaning people out there, they're searching for you. So those are the warmer leads. Still, you have to have a process, but they're much easier to convert than pay-per-click.
Yeah, the other challenge with pay-per-click is that it's so costly. I refer to it as an addiction. You can get some leads. Now, of course, I've heard all these stories about companies that get rich on pay-per-click. But for every one story like that, I hear 20 of people who paid money to pay-per-click and got nothing. So it's almost, I consider it's like going to Vegas. You could hit it big, but it's so challenging to figure out, because really when people are searching, they're not looking to click on ads. That's the psychology. People tend to scroll past it and go to the maps, Google Places, and go to the organic searches. So to get them to stop on your ad, you've got to really be keyed in on the key phrases, and the way you write that ad has to be masterful to get people to click on it. And if you're able to do that and then do the whole bidding and all that stuff and figure all that out, you could do well. But even if you do well, it's an addiction, because you're only getting leads as you're paying. You're paying, and you have to pay a lot. Versus what we do always works, because people are always going to the organic. That's why they search to find the organic rankings. So we're providing them the helpful content that they're looking for. And so it always works when you get there, and you're paying much less to get leads this way than you would be with the pay-per-click.
Now, you were talking before about how SEO without social media isn't as effective. What are maybe the, for people out there who are, you know, on Facebook, on Twitter right now, what are the weaknesses or problems with social media minus SEO?
Well, social media, it's a different channel, it's a different animal, but at the end of the day, they still are going to come to your website. So you still, your website is the spider in the web, like. From there, everything goes to social media and comes back. So still, your website has to be ready. You have to SEO your website so that people, through what channel they come to your website, still get the information and can find the information they're looking for, and that they like the information that they're looking for. So it's always a combination. It never stands on its own.
Yeah, what the challenge I find with social media is growing contacts. In other words, your Facebook page, we use it simply for a link, right? And it's there, right? Because we know it's part of Google's algorithm, Google Plus. These things are part of the algorithm. So when you're connecting your blogs, post them, those link backs make those articles more powerful. That's the spider web, the link effect, right? Which is what we're doing. But beyond that, if you're just posting on Facebook these original little pictures with the quote on and all, and that, which is good, a lot of companies do that, that's only going to help you if you have a lot of followers. So that's the challenge, is if you're just doing that kind of, if you're just doing that type of marketing, you've got to have some kind of strategy to grow your massively your followers for that to be effective. Now, what we do is we do focus on LinkedIn. We don't grow followers. We don't help them add contacts. What we focus on is the groups, because there's thousands of people in the target markets of the that the MSPs are looking for, like lawyers. Now, that's something that has legs, because you don't have to go join. You don't have to try to get 1,000 followers. There's already 2,000 or 3,000 lawyers in that group. You just have to start posting the content in the group.
All right. So that was David Walter and Johan Beekman from MSP SEO Factory. There's a lot to dive in here, Rich. Some very interesting discussion on the models for lead generation, hot versus cold, referrals versus good leads. Where do you want to sink our teeth into this one?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. In fact, there are all sorts of really interesting nuggets there, especially if, like me, a lot of this stuff is very new to you. So I thought it was interesting, part of what makes this interesting, too, is that so much of it is based on experience. This is not theory. It's like they've been doing this for a while, and they've learned some things about what works and what doesn't. And so it was interesting to me that you can't rely on any one particular kind of content. That you get the best results when you're mixing blogs with white papers and video and audio and whatever. I thought that was really interesting. And I really found his discussion about the differences between search engine optimization and pay-per-click and search engine marketing kind of interesting. It just sort of helped clarify the strengths and weaknesses of each of those approaches.
Yeah, so I've seen a few different services and models that kind of do this kind of stuff. You pick your keywords, and then you generate content that helps, lure the people in and make you the definitive source. But I've seen various ways that of what they present to Google versus what the user sees when they get to the site. One is, this optimized bunch of gunk that Google likes to see. I don't know if that's how their system works, but what is your thoughts, Rich, just about, the whole Google game and coming up with services that kind of try to get you to the top of the Google listings?
Well, and I think that's where the whole discussion about hot versus cold leads comes into play, and is sort of an interesting take on things. Because just by nature, by definition, basically, if somebody is using a search engine and conducting searches, they are looking for information on a given topic. As opposed to kind of stumbling across a pay-per-click ad that you created. I just thought it was an interesting point that the advantage SEO offers is that you're reaching people who are interested in something that you do. So to the extent that they can really sort you towards the top of these search lists and build awareness for your brand and so on. I mean, it sounds like a pretty appealing marketing model.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff. All right. Very cool. Well, I guess we're going to take our final break. When we come back, we're going to come in with our end of the show regular features that we do. And I've got a museum and a tech pick for y'alls. So stick around for that, and we'll be right back. All right. And we are back for segment 3 here of Channel Pro Weekly, our regular end-of-the-show roundup. So week to week, we follow our associate publisher Joel Zaidspinner around the country as he represents Channel Pro at events and shindigs all over this great globe, to the point where he's gone a lot. And, Rich, we've got a little bit of an emergency.
Uh-oh, what's that?
Joel has not been on Skype for Business in 92 days. I think he's missing.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that is an emergency. Yeah. So I think we have to draw on our audience here. Has anyone seen Joel?
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea where he is. He could
yeah,
be home.
Well, I mean,
he could be on the road. I remember he was gearing up for a really, really, really long trip. I just don't know if I can't remember if he was leaving this week or next week.
I believe it's next week. Yeah. So I mean, I was going to say, you know, I know where he's not. He's not here at the CompTIA meeting. This is the kind of conference he would normally attend. But he decided to skip it this time around, and you know, I was here, and our boss Michael Siggins, Channel Pro publisher, was here. He figured we had the situation in hand, and he was taking a little bit of a breather, kind of pacing himself, because yeah, he's got this big trip coming up where he's going to be hopping from one place all over the country. So probably a wise move on his part to conserve a little energy.
Yeah, so like Jimmy Hoffa, we don't know where Joel is. So if you see him, let us know where he's at. Just we want to make sure that he's safe. Speaking of Mr. Siggins, though, we did promise a few shows ago that we were going to get the great boss man on the show with us. And we are still working on that. We do plan on having him on. He's a busy guy, as we all know. So we haven't been able to have our schedules kind of all align perfectly to make this happen. But we are trying to get him on so we can grill him on the history of Channel Pro. And he's a fascinating guy to listen to. He's very funny. He's an awesome guy. So we have not forgotten about that. We do have that in the works. So look forward to that in a future show. Unless you know anything different, Rich. You've been with him all week.
No, he will definitely be on, and you know, this is obviously we want to have him on just because he's never been on, and people have not heard from him, and like you say, he is a good person to hear from, but also because this month is the 10th anniversary of the very first print issue of Channel Pro, and we're all in a celebratory mood here, and it would be nice to get Michael on and chat a little bit about the early days.
Absolutely. Very cool. All right. So my museum pick this week is a special device that we probably all fondly remember and might have used back in the day. This was before the era of smartphones and kind of in that transition between the little weird digital organizers and these Palm Smart devices. In fact, it is a Palm Smart device. So my museum pick this week is the Palm 3 and the Palm 3C. I actually have one of each in my museum. The picture that I will put online is of my Palm 3C, which is the color version that came out after the Palm 3. So, Rich, did you ever have a Palm device?
I didn't. I had a very similar compact device, but no, I never did have a Palm.
Yeah, I do have I have a whole museum full of these PDA kind of devices. One, because I used a lot of different ones when I was trying to find one that would work well for me. But also because I found this category just completely fascinating. And I also find it interesting how this category has basically completely been replaced and integrated into cell phones, as many, many things have been. But the Palm, I have a lot of Windows CE devices too. But the Palm devices were, I think, a little bit simpler to use. In fact, you can kind of look at this and say, like, it almost is iPhone-like. Just a very, you know, an icon-driven UI. Now, this was stylus-based. It wasn't very touch-friendly. But it had handwriting recognition. It had a lot of really great built-in apps that were very, very easy to use. It could sync with the computer through, like a dock. So it supported, you know, various protocols to sync information to your computer. It had, and they had, one of the more compelling marketplaces for third-party applications that was very simple to use and do. So you could buy these like big CDs at the software store that had a whole bunch of Palm programs on it that you could run and then easily load onto your Palm. So I don't want to say there was a centralized store for third-party applications for these devices, because there weren't. But you could get these centralized dumps of programs to try out in various forms, which made it a little bit easier to deal with. So the Palm 3, there was the Palm, there was a Palm 2, and they were a little bigger. I think I have an original Palm in there too. But the Palm 3 was the one that really elevated Palm up to the mainstream usage level. It was thin. It had really good battery life. It had a backlight on it, so there's a little green button you could press to turn the backlight on. Now, the original version was a monochrome screen, but I don't find that the monochrome screen really made the device any less usable. You weren't doing a lot of things like browsing photographs and that kind of stuff with these, and this was kind of pre-browsing the web on a regular basis, so at least if you were, the web was a very different kind of thing. Back, it was very text-driven. So the monochrome screen versus the color screen didn't really add a whole lot to the experience, but it was a really, really good device to use, and the handwriting recognition was very interesting. You'd draw, like, letters in a certain way in this little box and numbers, and then it would translate those. And you could, when you got good at that, at the way you needed to write the letters, because you had to write a T a little differently and some stuff like that. It wasn't natural handwriting. It was like their format. But it was really cool. It had a lot of great apps. And I have very fond memories of the Palm 3 and the Palm 3C. So, Rich, you said you used a Windows CE device?
Yeah. Actually, two different ones. The first one I got was monochrome, and then later on I got a color one. And yeah, that, and you know, like you say, actually, the monochrome one was great. You know, I mean, I suppose the color device was a little bit easier on the eyes, but it was also kind of a heavier one, as I remember. That monochrome device was slim and fast, and yeah, that was a real handy thing to have back in the day.
Yeah, we did talk about at least one Windows mobile device in this category, this PDA category. Back in episode 16, I brought out my HP iPac Pocket PC, which was one of the better back in the day when this was still a kind of a there's still these things are still built because they're good for, you know, they have various industrial uses, barcode scanning and inventory tracking and, you know, that kind of stuff. But as far as like a business executive PDA data manager, one of the better ones. So you can go back and listen to episode 16 if you want to hear a little bit about the Windows mobile ones. And trust me, I have many more PDAs to show off here on Windows. On Windows, I have many more. I have many more Windows PDAs and other interesting devices to show off here on Channel Pro Weekly.
Now, I do not know very much about the fate of the Palm brand. HP bought Palm, and then at some point in time, Palm kind of, at least as a brand name, went away. But I don't know very much about that evolution. Do you know anything about that?
Sure. Yeah. So Palm, kind of when the iPhone was released. Palm had one last ditch effort to come out with a new smartphone operating system, because devices like the Treo, which were very popular, which were like smartphones that used the Palm OS, really fell by the wayside, as did the Windows ones too. So it was like, it's the iPhone. So Palm came out with WebOS. You remember that name, WebOS?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they partnered with T-Mobile, or was it Sprint? Oh, it was one of the two. Crap. Sprint or T-Mobile? I will find out. For this really cool, very modern smartphone using WebOS. I might have one in my museum, so I don't want to ruin anything for a future show. But that was Palm's kind of last ditch effort. Was their WebOS phone? I'm trying to remember what the name of it was called. It had a certain name to it. What was it called? The Palm Pre, is what it was called. I may or may not have one of those in my museum. I'm not going to say if I do or don't. But the Palm Pre was the phone, and then they came up with the Pixie after that. So after WebOS had a huge following. It was beautiful. It worked really well. It had a very, very modern layout. Lots of companies kind of ripped off a lot of components of WebOS. And that eventually kind of got bought by HP in 2010. And then it kind of didn't really go anywhere. HP didn't really do a whole lot with it. And then they sold it to LG. And WebOS today exists as a smart TV interface at LG. So that's probably more history than you wanted to know.
It just, you know, Palm is a brand. I mean, it was this huge presence in the tech world. It was a big brand. It was one of those brands that even people who don't know very much about the computer industry were familiar with. They you know, kind of owned that PDA category for a while. And it just occurred to me as we were looking at this device, I don't really know what became of Palm.
Yeah, that's what happened to him. So it's innovator die, and when you get a market disruptor like the iPhone was, and it really was, it put a lot of these companies that had stylus-driven, text-oriented user interfaces by the wayside, who are using resistive technology for screens, not finger-friendly. They really had a hard time coming back after that, and Palm is a perfect example. And even though the Palm Pre sold really well, it was on Sprint. It sold extremely well, but it just wasn't enough to overcome the iPhone and the App Store that went with it. And it's kind of what, you know, if we kind of look at what's killing Windows phones too, it's the same thing, is that if you can't get developer support behind it, it's really hard to make a play in smartphones these days. So that's where they're at. So we might take a look at that particular device down the road, now that we've kind of talked about it all in this episode. So I'll wait until everybody's forgotten we've talked about it in this episode, and then we'll do it again. not saying that I do or do not have one of those things. Anyway, my tech pick this week is a laptop from Acer. I haven't picked a laptop in a while. So my tech pick this week is the Acer Swift 7. So, Rich, I threw a link there so you can take a look at this thing.
Yeah.
There's a couple reasons why I picked this as my tech pick. One, because it's really hard to pull off gold and black on a laptop together to give it an executive look that doesn't look corny. And I think Acer pulled it off. It looks amazing. What do you think? Do you think you like that look?
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at these pictures, and so yeah, the black and gold is nice, but I mean, the thing that leaps off the screen here is how skinny this thing is. I'm trying to find the specs and see.
0.4 inches.
Wow. Yep.
I know. I don't know how much skinnier they can make these things, because like eventually, like you're just gonna snap it in two. But it's crazy thin. But I think the styling on this, it's a gold with black chiclet keyboard, black kind of screen, but the way they mix them together is very elegant looking. It almost looks like a, you know, like a high-end Movado watch. And I am ripping that term off from our reviewer at large, Mr. James Gaskin, who happened to write a review of this particular laptop for us. So I will put a link to that review in our show notes. It's a pretty cool laptop, and I think it would be a head turner. So go and check that out. Now, Rich, I've long said that you possess magical powers. Did you know that?
That I possess magical powers, or that
yes.
you have said, okay, yes.
Yes, you have, you well, are, you, in some kind of magical way, you have this amazing ability to predict the past at 100% accuracy. It's amazing. You can tell us what happened, and you'll get it right every single time. I don't know how you do it. It's got to be magic.
Well, I certainly make it look like magic, but it's just practice, 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 man.
So, our dear Rich, tell us what has been and what will be.
Well, what we are alluding to here is my weekly roundup of the news from the technology world, called In Case You Missed It. Runs every Friday on channelpronetwork.com. And this week we're going to be looking at some announcements out of the IBM and Adobe conferences that took place in Las Vegas this week. A new iPad from Apple, a big new line of solid-state drives from Intel that I desperately wanted to write about on our website and just couldn't scrape up the time for. And then we will take a look at Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame doing his best impression of Sigourney Weaver from Aliens. In What's Up This Week? So every Monday morning, first thing in the morning, I encourage you to come to channelpronetwork.com and check out my weekly What's Up This Week post, which takes a look at the week ahead, lets you know what is going to be happening in our industry. Next week, that includes the Digital Signage Expo in Las Vegas, biggest show of the year in that market. The Enterprise Connect show for communications and collaboration technology that's going on in Orlando. The Varnex partner community of Synnex partners, they get together next week. We also get a quarterly financial update from Synnex, actually, in the same week. And then since we celebrated a couple of serendipitously timed birthdays last week in the What's Up This Week post, I think we'll do it again this week. Next weekend, it turns out, is the 49th birthday of HAL, the evil computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey, or at least the movie version of that. It's also the 18th birthday of the even eviler computer in the movie The Matrix. So it's an evil computer birthday weekend.
Ooh, we always love the evil computers. I actually just sent a meme to Michael. There's a HAL meme generator you can use. And Michael said he was going to do something, and I sent him a little picture with HAL and said, I'm sorry, Michael, I can't let you do that. Okay, so I do have to ask you this, though, because I thought the exact same thing when I saw that picture of Jeff Bezos in the giant robot thing.
Yes.
And I'm like, now, do you believe that the end of the world is coming after seeing that?
it seems like at least once or twice a week I see something that makes me, fear for the fate of humanity.
So I might be willing, if you want a custom graphic made, I might be willing to Photoshop that picture to make Jeff Bezos look more like Sigourney Weaver. We could do like a half and half face, blend it together. We'll have to think about that. If you haven't seen that picture, when you think Amazon, you think, oh, I'm going to go and order toothpaste, you know? But then when you see the, CEO of Amazon, like, talking about launching stuff to Mars and, like, in these giant robot suits, the aliens are coming. I'm telling you right now, they're coming.
We obviously will have a picture of that in case you missed it. So that would be a great place to come check out what we're talking about here.
Go to the show notes and find a link to that. It's scary. That's all I want to say. It's super, super scary. All right. We record Channel 4 Weekly now every week. Hell or high water, I like to say. We usually always try to post them on Fridays. Last week it was Saturday. Our new podcast editor had a personal matter, and she just couldn't get to the show until Saturday morning, so that's okay. But again, 12 hours late is nowhere near as bad as the 2 weeks late when it was me doing it. So every Friday we try to get these shows out and to you for some good weekend listening while you do other things. If you have not subscribed, please, please, please subscribe to us on we are on iTunes, we are on Google Play, we are on Stitcher. We're just about everywhere where you would want to listen to us. If you just have a regular old podcast app and you don't see us in there, But you can drop an RSS feed. You can use channelpronetwork.com/RSS/CPW. And then we will fly down to you as soon as a new show hits the wire. So once you do that, while you're at Google Play and iTunes, please leave a positive rating. If you got to leave a negative rating, fine. But don't leave a negative rating. Leave a positive rating, because it only will get better if you tell us that we're good. And it'll help other people find the show, which is important. The more people we get, the more we can make this show better for you. If you have any feedback, we'd love to hear it. We do want to do a reader or listener mailbag kind of segment down the road at some point. So get those comments in if you want to say anything about your thoughts in the industry, about things we said that you don't agree with, things that you do agree with, whatever it is. Send us an email, podcast@channelpronetwork.com. We are also on the social medias. We are Channel Pro Network on Facebook. We are at Channel Pro SMB on Twitter. Rich is what on Twitter?
At Rich Free.
And I am at Matt Whitlock on Twitter, so feel free to follow us on all of your social hangout kind of places. And yeah, that's it for episode 37. 37, yeah, wow. Cecilia should be back with us next week, so I thank you for listening to this testosterone-laced man edition of Channel Pro Weekly. But we look forward to having Cecilia back with us next week. So until then, thank you all for listening, and we will see you soon.